The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts,
Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. Welcome to the BioRevolution Podcast. Welcome, Izzy.
Hello.
Today we'd like to approach science itself, standing, outlook, present and future. There are headlines that may worry the scientific community. The value of facts seems to be increasingly questioned by those in power, by those in control of assets. If evidence to those who make laws and regulate science is not a reliable source anymore, what will become of the progress we're specifically discussing here at the BioRevolution Podcast? Let's get going, as always, with quotes, Izzy.
Yeah, and today I have to say I was really struggling with which quotes to select, because there are a lot of quotes on science communication and on the question of politicizing of science. But I feel that these quotes somehow go in a direction that I don't really like so much. So I'm actually going to go quite far back to the year 1945 to Mr. Vannevar Bush, who also might be a little bit questionable character. I would say thought father maybe of the Manhattan Project, or at least leading in its initiation, but also an important science advisor during the time of World War II. And after the finishing of World War II, there was this large science report to the president by Vannevar Bush and a commission. And what the scientists within this document concluded was that scientific progress is an essential key to our security as a nation, to our better health, to more jobs, to a higher standard of living, and to our cultural progress. And based on this report, I think for a long time, this was agreement among scientists, politicians, and society in the United States, but also, I would say, in large parts of Western Europe, and I would say the rest of the world, that science is an important instrument for progress and also for maintaining a high standard of living across all domains. And I think we're seeing that being challenged a little bit at the moment, and this is what we would like to talk about today.
And there's evidence from like flying to the moon, to the internet itself, to curing diseases, obviously, and increasing lifespans. Science is a success story beyond comparison. What have been major victories in the past few years?
So our lens, of course, is the biomedical one, because we're the BioRevolution Podcast, and also I'm a biologist, so this is what I feel confident talking about. So I would say, for example, the COVID vaccines can be seen as
most
a major
definitely
scientific breakthrough that allowed us to get back to normal life and overcome this pandemic, which already cost a lot of lives, but which would have cost many more lives without vaccines. Then we have new developments in terms of cancer therapies, cancer immunotherapies, for example, that are now allowing to treat cancer types which before were a clear death sentence. And going further back, of course, we know that in general, the development of vaccines and the development of antibiotics are a key factor to increase our life expectancy from this maybe 40 years on average, 100 years ago, to the around 80 years on average worldwide. And of course, there are other factors, better nutrition, better sanitization that play a role, but this still was instrumental. So we know that science not only improves our life conditions, it clearly improves our lifespans. And we see, of course, also with new medication for now more the chronic diseases, the diseases of ages, that we might further increase not only our lifespan, but also our health span. And we see, for example, I mean, we talked about it many times, but the leads from medications around diabetes like metformin and potentially also now with the GLP-1 agonists, that those might have a positive effect on our lifespan. And I also have to say, we always jokingly put out there that we're looking, I mean, what humanity is really looking for is this magic pill that allows us to eat anything. We don't gain weight. I mean, it's not quite true, but we have come a little bit closer to that one even. So yeah, that said, I think science is making a lot of progress and will continue to make a lot of progress if we allow it to do so.
Yeah, and in a sense, thinking about sitting down talking with you in this podcast, it's simply a no-brainer. But then there's trust. And generally, there's been a huge wave of trust in the, you mentioned that, the post-World War II era, just like a belief that science will help make lives better. And it did, as you just mentioned. But then social media enters the scene and COVID strikes and the landscape changes all of a sudden. Are there current data you can refer to?
Yeah, there is a lot of current data and there are a lot of current surveys. And I have to say they deviate a little bit, which makes it a little bit hard to integrate the data. There's a recent study that came out, which I think interviewed almost 80,000 participants across many different countries worldwide. And they find a generally overall worldwide rather high level of trust in science among the people that they queried. So they have a scale from 1 to 5, and I think on average they land somewhere 3.6. So they're more on the positive side when it comes to trust in science. And interestingly also, it doesn't seem to be very dependent. So it's not like the rich Western democracies that have the highest trust in their scientists. Actually, on place one with the highest trust in science, we find Egypt, followed by India, Nigeria, Kenya, Australia, and then UK, Canada, Germany, Sweden, these kind of countries, they're more in the middle. And also in this survey, the US is actually quite high. I think they're on place 12 or something. So it doesn't appear that the average of the people that were queried there have a low trust in scientists and in science per se. And then we find other surveys from the year before that also, again, analyzed trust in science across a little bit smaller sample. But also there we find, first of all, a generally rather high trust in science, and also find that it seems to be independent or not so dependent on the political system, and that interestingly in countries that we would not see as classical democracies and more as autocratic systems, like for example China or Turkey, the trust in science is pretty equal to that in democracies. And the interesting difference is that in democracies, the political view, if you're left-leaning or if you're right-leaning, seems to influence very much how much you trust science. This is not the case in non-democratic systems, at least according to this study, where they say both left and both right-leaning people who live in non-democratic states have a relatively high trust in science. But in democracies, and we see that very specifically in the United States, but we're also seeing it appearing across Europe, we see this increase in mistrust in science in the political right. Trust in science is higher amongst women, and also women scientists are being trusted more, which might lead us somewhere.
Yeah, it might, and hopefully eventually it will. With the dawn of COVID and the vaccine, there's also the wave of the no-vaxxers, and who are, in a sense, kind of attached to the populist overall movement. This also builds the stage for science's gray zone and the attached problem, right?
Here, what we're seeing with the anti-vaxxers, unfortunately, this is a movement that hasn't only been present since COVID, but this is something that has its roots most likely in a fraudulent paper from 1998, so it's quite a while ago. And their researchers around Andrew Wakefield said that vaccines cause autism. And first of all, they couldn't show this. That was just a correlation that did not show the causation. And also there were other flaws in the study. So the paper got retracted, but this image of vaccines cause autism somehow really stuck with large parts of the population. And interestingly, this is not, I would say, really strongly linked, or initially not strongly linked to a political side, but more to people who mistrust, I think, in general, medicine, maybe, which I think happens on both sides of the political aisle. It's more this back to nature kind of trend, and also this idea that we know best what to do with our bodies and that modern medicine might not be the best partner. And then you just take, a lot of supplements and we'll thrive on those. But I think vaccines in general, of course, have a higher hurdle to be trusted than other medications because you're preventing a disease. So, I mean, you're probably never going to experience what you're being protected from. And I think it's much, much easier to buy into doing something, a medical procedure, taking a medication, if you already have something. And I think not knowing the dramatic effects that we had of many diseases like polio, but also simple things like measles, which we're seeing huge recurrence now again in the United States and across Europe. These are severe diseases, but we have generations that did not experience them because everyone was vaccinated, because we had herd immunity. But if we lose that again, we'll get these diseases back and then we'll get all the negative impact of that. And I think here, really during COVID, I think this culminated something that had already been brewing for a while, that people started to link a political agenda that interfered with their way of living to a medical message or a scientific message. Scientific message being get vaccinated because science says it's safe. And of course, also all the other pandemic measures that were at least largely science informed. And then people saw that as interference with their right to their own way of living, basically.
Which it essentially was, you know.
Exactly.
With the restrictions of moving freely and stuff like that. Of course, fair enough, right?
It was. And I think that this negative link of scientific messages to interference with one's way of life, I would say, might be actually at the root of the problem. And I think here it's really this question of what are we communicating? And I think this is why I had some quotes on how we position facts. And I think this is extremely difficult topic. And I'm thinking about that a lot because for me, I based some of this episode on a blog article that I wrote at the height of COVID, where I was really completely bashing the people who believe in alternative facts and was like, kind of this view, like, how can you be so stupid? A part of me still believes that, but I think there must be something deeper rooted that we're seeing there, because it cannot be that everyone is just stupid. And if everyone's just stupid, we need to do a better job to help them overcome that. It's a little bit like if you're teaching a class and no one gets what you're saying and you say like, yeah, but they're all to dump what I'm trying to say. And
it's not sufficient.
It cannot be the conclusion somehow.
Right.
But at the same time, much of what is being told are scientific facts. And I think the problem, and this is where we get to what you mentioned before, the gray zone, facts are in science, I think, something different than people might perceive or might wish for from the outside, because what they want are hard facts that don't change. And in science, everything that you find just raises the next question. And it might very well be that three labs study the same thing and find three different findings. And we need to be aware of that. And we also need to be able to communicate that. And I think what has happened a little bit during COVID, and I would also see myself as a bit guilty of that, is that we were very focused on factfulness versus alternative facts and idiotic opinions, kind of, that you say, yeah, but this is science, these are facts. And to an extent, I think this is also true, that we say we have a better analysis of the data here. But I think having a bit more view of the gray zone, and I think being more tolerant towards other voices, even if they say something that you don't like to hear, might be a way to address this, I think, what many people perceive as sort of a dictatorship of science, which of course does not exist. And then, which brings me to the next point, and I have to say this whole topic makes me very agitated, which one might hear here, because
yes.
because this has really the potential to be extremely detrimental, what's happening in the United States at the moment. And the problem is that, yes, Trump and Musk are problems, yes, but they are symptoms. They are not the underlying disease. The underlying disease is that there is half of the population who want very, very simple answers to very complex questions. And somehow we need to get to these people to allow them to think more critically again, because it cannot be the solution to say, okay, you're stupid and let's go our separate ways, because we don't have a chance to go our separate ways. We need to somehow continue to live together.
It adds up if the Secretary of Health is RFK.
Yeah.
That doesn't make it better.
No, that doesn't make it better.
An anti-vaxxer.
Yeah, who says he's not an anti-vaxxer, which doesn't make it better.
It doesn't make sense also.
No, it doesn't make sense because he clearly is. So I think communicating science in all its complexity will be important. But the problem is that a lot of the complexity is what is being weaponized, I think, by certain populist ideas. And I think this is really the challenge because you want to have discourse and you want to be open to other opinions, but at the same time, things that are in a sense consensus, where we would say most of the scientific community agrees that this is our conclusion from the data. Most of us agree that it's a good idea to get vaccinated against this infectious disease because otherwise it might start spreading and we get a lot of negative output of that. And if this is just weaponized as a political agenda, if it's said like this, but this is a woke kind of attitude and people want to interfere with your way of living. And this gets really challenging. And this, I mean, of course, does not only, I mean, vaccines are one of the hot topics, but anything gender related. And this is something where we also see that in Germany, like really badly, trust in science is generally high and also buy into scientific explanations of the world. But if it's about gender identity, it's only 37% who trust the scientific explanation. So showing that, I mean, there is a lot of ideology in there. And that, I think, for a scientist, it's just, it's putting you in such a conundrum because on the one hand, you want to shout, but I have the facts. And on the other hand, it's like then people say, yeah, but this is ideology. So how do we work around that to get to a discourse that on the one hand shows this gray zone, shows that scientists admit that even though they have a consensus interpretation of the situation, they also acknowledge that they might be wrong. Because in science, you will never prove a hypothesis. This is part of the scientific method. You can only find corroborating evidence and then you can form a new hypothesis and again find corroborating evidence. But you will never beyond doubt prove anything. And this is also fine. I mean, this is in general not a problem. But if we're starting to have these topics where this idea between what is facts and what is alternative facts becomes so politicized and so weaponized in the discussion, and we see that for climate change, we see that for any gender-related things, and we see that for vaccines and also for many other topics, but I think these are three very hot areas where we're also seeing now this real massive backlash from the Trump administration, where I think we need to somehow get to a level where we get, I think the first step might be to just get back into the discourse.
I'm standing on the communication side of things in the equation, not the scientific side. And what is constantly coming to my mind is that science communication is not a gray or a white spot. I would never say that. But I see that the tendency to leave ivory towers, to speak the people's language, in a sense, also to translate scientific evidence into political process, into civic society, doesn't take place in a manner that I would call sufficient. So we're not there yet. Fair enough, scientists for the longest time could fair and square say and claim, this is not my cup of tea. This is not my business. But today, that is really changing. And I think better communications might be one key to revive trust in science.
Yeah, and this is one, I think, of the very interesting outcomes of this huge survey that I mentioned before that came out just, I think, 2 weeks ago, that I think more than 90% of the people that were surveyed wished for a scientist to communicate science to the general public, and more than half of the people actually wished for scientists to be more involved in policy making. So it's, I mean, seems to be that in general, scientists are being trusted and scientists are seen as competent individuals who should talk to the world about their findings and who should also be involved in putting those into action. So I think on the one hand, we have still the general trust of people in science, but we see, I think, this massive deviation when it comes to what is perceived as politicized science. And here, yeah, I think we really need to find a way to communicate these topics also in a way that, again, gets people into the discourse and into the agenda. But on the other hand, I also have to say that we still, I think, have this chance to keep the communication open and to keep the discourse going at the moment, for example, in Europe or in other democratic states. But in America, I think it's getting, I mean, the water is really rising for scientists at the moment. And I think this is, I mean, this is extremely severe. It's been called unprecedented by former NIH president. And I think it's really true that in these 30 days, there have been changes made that are really hard to reverse and already have caused so much damage that we're really seeing, yeah, I mean, what, and there was a book out in 2016 that was called The War on Science, actually before even the first Trump administration, who already summed up this weaponizing of what is perceived as politicized science. And just building on that, we really see, I think we have seen that in the 4 years of the first Trump administration. We see it again. It's a real war on science. But I think we are also not in a position where we can lay back here and say, yeah, but here our trust in science is high and this will not happen. Because I think, again, the problem is that people are, so I can only speculate what is underlying this strong aversion against these topics of climate change, for example, or gender studies or whatever it is. But whatever might be underlying, I think it's fear of complexity. I think it's fear of losing privileges. I think it's just perceiving science as being in the wrong place. It's perceiving that either science is influenced by politics too much or that scientists actually express their political views. And covariates that always come out in the surveys are, I mean, all of that is non-surprising, that people with a higher educational status, people who consume more scientific media, people who live in urban areas, they have much higher trust in science. And I mean, this, yeah, right, we probably wouldn't need studies for that, or we could guess that this is the case. But I think it's really a question of positioning scientists as elites that you cannot trust. And we've seen that, I mean, with politicians, and we've seen that with your professions, with journalists, that the, I mean, trust has massively decreased amongst the public. And I mean, not only in the United States, but also, for example, in Germany. And I think the scientists are the next wave of people who are perceived as elites who transport messages you don't want to hear and that you don't trust anymore. And interestingly, we still have these high levels of trust. And interestingly, what I found really interesting is that the general trust in science is seems to be not that influenced by the political system, even though in Russia and former Soviet countries, trust was rather low in comparison. But I think in general, this idea of having an authority that also works towards the betterment of humanity, which, I mean, we see in this Anheuser Busch report in 45, I think this is still the case that most people perceive scientists like that. And somehow, I think maintaining and strengthening this image will be really important. And what you say about communication, I think this is really the key, that we keep up the communication. But it's also, I think, really challenging in the age of social media, where we have a lot of people who take scientific facts and put them in a very narrow context. I mean, this is especially true, for example, for the field of nutrition, where in general, I mean, it's often a little bit more difficult to draw conclusions from what you're supposed to eat and not to eat, or what kind of supplements you're supposed to take and not to take. But also in other sciences like psychology, where I think you have millions of people on TikTok who tell you scientific or pseudoscientific things. And disentangling that and filling that with real science, I think it just gets very difficult, because then we have a gray zone that is not scientific discourse. And the problem is that the easy solutions and the easy answers are just more appealing, I think, to many people, because they are easier. And if we communicate science in its full complexity and with all this gray zone, that we often have to get to the conclusion that we simply don't know the answer, even though we've done a lot of studies and it's still doesn't give us the answer that we were looking for. I think this is very, very challenging for many people to accept, which then turns them again to the easier answers.
looking at pharma, looking at the biorevolution, I mean, there's consequences. If those bodies you mentioned, NIH, CDC, that are, yeah, basically dismantled, what is your prediction there?
Yeah.
When it comes to the loss of belief in science, what consequences does that have for the biorevolution?
This is a really good question because on the one hand, now we see this freeze of funding for NIH, NHS in the United States. I mean, they had to pause clinical studies. Imagine being in a clinical study where you're supposed to get your next dose of medication and then the money is frozen. I mean, how crazy is this? But what I find a little bit strange, at least from what I can see, is how quiet pharma and biotech are about what is happening. And now the CEO of Recursion stepped up and started a fund to battle this, what will result in an innovation crisis, of course. If you don't have money for basic research and for clinical research, then, I mean, this basic research that's being done in academia and the academic spin-outs is what fuels the innovation in biotech and then leading up to that in pharma. So somehow I think the industry, I mean, needs to get involved in this situation and also needs to pick up the slack to a certain extent to continue to have innovative science. Because if you don't have that, yeah, you cannot replenish your pipelines. You don't get any new discoveries. And I mean, we discussed it many times that many of these discoveries that seem to appear out of the blue, like the COVID vaccines, there were people standing in a lab for 30 years in quiet working on that with very little grant money to get to this point that this magical invention could come out of the blue because people had done a lot of research previously. And this is what happens from almost all scientific discovery. I think we get this, and again, this is a perception problem. This image, you know, of Alexander Fleming standing in the lab finding penicillin over the weekend, and the next day people are treated with that. But there are, I don't know, 10, 15 years of actually extraction and developing this into a drug in between. So it's not the eureka moment that leads to getting a scientific innovation, but it's this long collaborative work of different scientists that usually results in new innovation. And then if you cut off a lot of funding and also if you cut, and this is, I think, very ideological, the type of research that can be done, because there is now limitations for which grants can be funded, and they have like a selection of, for example, women's research, or if you have a word like bias in there, then the grant should not be funded anymore. But bias, I mean, this is something that this is not ideological, this is statistics bias. So, and especially like we had last year this episode on women's health, which was last time I was so angry for recording. Now I'm equally, if not more angry, where again, like if we don't fund, I mean, this is not about any gender-related, I don't know, studies. If we study something that has an effect on women's health, I mean, this is, if you study endometriosis, I mean, this is non-ideological. This is simply a condition that women have because of their physiology and men don't.
Simple as that, yeah.
In the same sense, you could say, yeah, okay, let's not study prostate cancer anymore because that only affects men. Really doesn't make sense. So I wonder if Europe can help to build more innovation, because I know, and also this is something that we've been talking about a lot, we are quite dependent, or the United States are very driving when it comes to scientific innovation. There is usually more money put into biomedical research, drug prices are higher. So in general, it's just a very powerful place in terms of drug discovery, in terms of biomedical innovation. So the question is, can the rest of the world position themselves in a stronger way? And this is maybe not only Europe, but maybe also China, for example, to pick up a little bit and complement this. And I think this in general would be a good idea. And I don't think it's a good idea that the drug prices are so high in the United States. I think this is also terribly unfair, actually, that they have to pay three times as much as the rest of the world. This, I mean, also really doesn't make sense. But the current cuts of funding and personnel and directionality of where research is supposed to go are definitely not an answer to this crisis, I think.
So Europe would be a perfect and a wonderful place for all this if it were something more than a Club of 27 and would like come together in this sense a little bit more. By the way, I saw the first ads, like in LinkedIn, I think, where US scientists were invited. Hey, if you don't have a good science landscape and surroundings anymore, come over to Europe. We have wonderful universities and other scientific institutions beyond the joke. Do you see any scenario where this might become real?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, it might be that we get an influx of more science talent, maybe, because I think, I mean, many of the researchers in the United States, I've also, like in the lab that I worked in Seattle, are of course also not Americans, but are researchers from all over the world who come there to work together. So it might be that we get more influx of talent from all over the world, maybe even from America, to work in our labs. So yes, I think that might definitely be the case. But I think the problem is that in the end, we are facing the same struggles as the United States. I mean, we do not have at the moment, and I really hope this will be the case tomorrow again, because we have our elections tomorrow. I mean, we don't have the leadership that has the populist view at the moment, but we also have a significant part of our population, and we see the same in almost any European country, that we have this view of the world that includes a mistrust of established systems, of politics, of media, and of science. And I think we'll get the same struggles. I think we're just a little bit behind. But to be honest, from what we see and from the topics that we're experiencing, I think that we'll get the same challenges as they're seeing in the United States. I hope that this can be prevented here. And I think the discourse is still more factful and less politicized, mm-hmm. less ideological. I think one thing that might play a role is also that the role of churches is maybe a little bit different in Western Europe than it is in countries that have this very strong evangelical element, that also I think might penetrate into this anti-science movement, which, by the way, is interesting. In these surveys that I mentioned before, it seems that Muslim countries are much more aligned between science and religion, because it seems
very
to be
fascinating.
Less, I mean, and I have to say, all these surveys are usually, it's a tricky part of science if you ask people, to be honest. I still find it interesting. So, I mean, this is more speculation, but I think that this extreme conservatism that comes, I think, with this religious ideology there might also play a role. And I think in general, because of the bipartisan system in America, it's much more polar and divided, and we have a little bit more variation maybe in the political system. But we also have already a number of countries in Europe that have very right-wing governments, and they're facing the same problems. And I'm wondering, I mean, this is something that I heard in a podcast about this science crisis with Nature editor, who's been covering. So Nature, one of the most prominent magazines for science in the world, or maybe the most prominent. And the discussion there was if actually the populists, and now specifically the Trump administration, are trying to make people dumber. If people would be stupider, then you don't have to deal with, for example, the question of climate change, getting out of the Paris Agreement or leaving the WHO, all these things. Yeah, if you say like, yeah, we don't need that, we don't have to be part of that. But I mean, we also need to be aware that science is not only part of, I mean, we're the BioRevolution podcast, so we talk about biomedicine and we talk about vaccines and antibiotics. But I mean, science is also a big part, for example, of defense.
Of course it is.
So, sure. And of agriculture. So, I mean, it would, of course, be nice if we could say, like, let's live on a non-GMO world. But I mean, this at the current stage is not realistic anymore. We need fertilizers and we need
to feed the world.
The United States has only genetically modified crops, but these things also depend on scientific innovation. So it's a really tricky, tricky thing to say we get rid of science and we don't need all that. And I think where this would lead, so I'm always imagining this also as an idea for a dystopian novel, how would a world without science look like? So on the one hand, you get to this idea of like Handmaid's Tale, where it's all, you know, like very, very religiously driven, and you don't really discuss any scientific findings and any medical innovation anymore. But I think what would most probably happen is that you then also get like a very oligarchic system where, of course, the people who want to stay alive. And I mean, now we've seen who was there for the inauguration. There are a lot of people who are very interested in extending their own lifespans beyond what is currently possible.
100% true. Yes, of course.
And they are funding that with billions of dollars. And also for that, we will depend on scientific innovation. So the question is, would it then mean that only the people who can put their money into research, into biotech companies, have actually access to scientific innovation? And we're already, I mean, also we are already at a situation where we have this massive unfairness, right? Where we get new cancer therapeutics that might cure a sick child that have cost like 1 million, 2, 3 million. And then we have other drugs for malaria or similar that would cost $50 and which we don't have money for other regions of the world. And I think lack of scientific innovation and a strong government directionality of scientific innovation, unless we invent this great political system where finally we don't have elites and everyone will be happy, but I'm still looking for the system that might lead to that. So I think this is a really difficult question, and I think it will really lead to increase in an already very unfair system. And again, in the United States, I mean, the healthcare system is really unfair for a large, large number of the people there, much more so than we experience here. And having a lack of innovation is definitely no way to solve this problem.
Yeah, and this is one possibility of a doomsday, the medicine, pharma sector, science for the chosen few, what you just described, and what a world without science might look like. Not so good. So we'd like to invite everybody who listens right now, think about science a little bit, what it's good for, what it is doing for the betterment of your personal life, your individual life, and what potential is there in the time to come if scientific innovation will take place in the close future.
And I just want to stress again, I think what's really important and also important for anyone who thinks about that, I think if you're already listening to that, you're probably already at this step. So, but maybe also to include that into conversations, is to be open to the gray zone and to not cut off discussions with people who have a different opinion from yours, even though it might sometimes feel like that throwing facts is the solution. I think this actually is part of what leads to this alienation and also part of what allows populists to weaponize scientific facts as something that people don't want to hear. And I think it's going to be hard work, and it's going to be important work for scientists and for anyone who is involved in science or believes in science to defend this, to not reach the point where we get smallpox and polio back, because that would be very unpleasant.
Terrible. Yes. Yeah. Thank you very much for this disclaimer, Easy, because it's a steep curve, of course, because I truly believe it takes place on a very individual basis. Mm-hmm. So you have to work one-on-one. You cannot convince like a billion people at once, but an individual who is misunderstanding, misinterpreting science, and comes up with maybe a set of so-called alternative realities that don't have an evidence-based foundation, that makes it even harder for somebody who's convinced and has led a whole life with those convictions, of course. Thank you, Easy.
Thank you.
This was the BioRevolution podcast. Thank you very much for listening. We felt an urge to do exactly this. We are thankful for subscriptions. If you have topics you want us to cover, please write us at sciencetales.com. Thank you very much. Until next time at the BioRevolution podcast.
Thanks all for listening to my rant. And
it hasn't been a rant. No. It was very foundational and very evidence-based, as it should be.
Evidence-based rant. Tune in next time.